To go first of all this evening to Mark chapter 5. And we came to the end of the last class in verse 21, when Jesus, having cured legion, had now accompanied with his disciples by boat again, had crossed the Sea of Galilee, and had come back to Capernaum. Then we had the incident which we'd already considered regarding prayer and fasting. And so tonight we're going to commence in verse 22 of Mark chapter 5 with the incident which I suppose is well known to us, and that's the raising of Jairus' daughter. And I think it would be appropriate, so that we're all familiar, if we could read from verse 22 of Mark chapter 5 to the end of the chapter, because it's all appropriate to what we'll be discussing. Right. Now, it might be appropriate if you could keep some markers in Mark chapter 5, Matthew chapter 9, and Luke chapter 8. Matthew 9, Mark 5, and Luke 8. Because both of those miracles are recorded in those three synoptic gospels. They're not recorded at all in John's gospel. Now, although it was Jairus who comes to the master first, we'd like to look at the second miracle, and that was the certain woman which had an issue of blood. So we take Mark's account in Mark chapter 5, bearing in mind the master was on the way to Jairus' house when this incident occurred with the woman. There was a multitude, we are told in verse 24, which followed him and thronged him. So progress was difficult. Jairus naturally wanted the master to get there as quick as he could. But the crowds, the crush, the multitude that followed him prevented a very speedy journey. And whilst he was on his way, no doubt being jostled by the crowd, as it would seem to indicate, we have this incident concerning this woman. You will notice that she is unnamed. Or we're told that she was a certain woman, as if she was a particular woman and not just any woman. As if maybe there is some identification for this woman in the narrative. So she was a certain woman. But all we're told of her at this point is that she'd had an issue of blood for 12 years. We're not told what the issue of blood was. Many suggested that it was to do with childbirth, that after she had given birth, she had got this problem which had never cleared up. And verse 26 tells us she had suffered many things of many physicians and had spent all that she had and was nothing bettered but rather grew worse. Obviously, in those days, they hadn't got the sophistication and all the medical help as they have today, and therefore she no doubt, in desperation, had gone from one physician to another in the hope that she might be cured, but she got worse and not better. So she was obviously, by the time of the coming of the master, very weak and very sickly, because to lose blood constantly for that period of time would have left her in a very weak state. But from a spiritual point of view, there was something perhaps even worse, because if we go back to the law, to the Old Testament, if we go first of all to Leviticus chapter 15, the law was very specific concerning anyone who had an issue of blood. Leviticus 15 and verse 19. And if a woman have an issue, and her issue in her flesh be blood, she shall be put apart 7 days, and whosoever toucheth her shall be unclean unto the even. So an issue of blood was by law an unclean thing. And anybody who came into contact with any woman who had got this uncleanness were themselves unclean. And they were given various periods in time for which it, if it was cured, then she could be pronounced clean again. But if in verse 25 this issue continued, and if a woman have an issue of her blood many days out of the time of her separation, or if it run beyond the time of her separation, all the days of her uncleanness shall be as the days of separation, she shall be unclean. And therefore she had to be put without the camp, because she was declared to be unclean. If you go to Numbers chapter 5, this is endorsed for us. And you will notice significantly in Numbers chapter 5 that a woman with an issue of blood is spoken of in the same term as a leper. So that was the way they were viewed by the law and by the children of Israel, that a woman who had an issue of blood was as bad as someone who was a leper. So in verse 2 of Numbers chapter 5, command the children of Israel that they put out of the camp every leper and every one that hath an issue, and whoever is defiled by the dead. Both male and female shall ye put, without the camp shall ye put them, that they defile not the camps in the midst whereof I dwell. So she had no way of access to temple worship. She had no means of even staying within her household. She had no fellowship whatsoever with the congregation. She was totally and utterly put without the camp as a leper would be. So it took some courage on behalf of this woman, no doubt heavily veiled so that she would not be recognized, to come amongst a thronging multitude. I'm going to suggest a bit later on that she was known by the people of Capernaum. And therefore, they would have known that for 12 years, this woman had been without the camp. And of course, like with the leper colony, there were special places for these people to go to. And they were pronounced unclean. And if they wanted to come to gather food or whatever, they had to shout out and make it aware to everybody that they were unclean. And therefore this woman, no doubt struggling because she would have been weak, and if we've all been caught up in a crowd and with the hustling and the bustling, you know how easily it is to be knocked over or knocked from side to side. It must have been a tremendous feat for this woman to come to the place that she was. But of course she knew or believed that the only chance that she had of life again, basically, was to come into contact with the Master. And therefore she believed that if she would only touch the Master, then she knew that she would be cured. Now, if you can just go back to Matthew's account, Matthew chapter 9, again, I think we shall see this quite clearly. Verse 21 of Matthew chapter 9, for she said within herself, if I may but touch his garment, I shall be whole. So this demonstrated a knowledge of the Lord Jesus Christ and a faith on behalf of this woman, that she genuinely and utterly believed that if she could just come in contact with the Master, then she would be cured. You will notice in verse 20 that as she came eventually, she touched the hem of his garment. But if you go to Luke's account, you'll notice what Luke tells us about it. Luke chapter 8 and verse 44. She touched the border of his garment. Now one would have assumed that the hem of the garment was the border of the garment, but of course it's the border which was of particular significance. Now I'm sure we've all got this marked in our Bibles, but let's just remind ourselves of Numbers chapter 15, of the significance of the border of an Israelitish garment. Because God under the law had commanded them, Numbers chapter 15, that upon the borders of the garment, that was verse 38 says, Numbers 15 verse 38, speak unto the children of Israel and bid them that they make them fringes in the borders of their garments throughout their generations, and they put upon the fringe of the borders a ribbon of blue. And the purpose was that it shall be unto you for a fringe, that you may look upon it and remember all the commandments of the Lord and do them. And that ye seek not after your own heart and your own eyes after which you used to go whoring. Verse 40 emphasizes this, that you may remember and do all my commandments and be holy unto your God. And therefore the fringe, the hem, the border of the garment was of particular significance. And this woman obviously had some belief, some understanding that if she could just touch the hem of his garment, then she would be cured. Now you'll notice as we come back to verse 44 of Luke chapter 8, we're told that she came to him from behind. She came to him from behind. So no doubt she'd had to jostle and push and shove to get as close as she could to the garment of the Lord. And to touch the hem of his garment, she would have had to bend down at least. She would have had to stoop down in order that she may touch the hem of his garment. And we can't underestimate her commitment to the cause, because it wouldn't have been easy. We've got to think of the multitude. Now in verse 29 of Mark chapter 5, we find that as soon as she did it, straightway, we're told in verse 29, the fountain of her blood was dried up, and she felt in her body that she was healed of that plague. So immediately she felt the difference. She appreciated that the fountain of her blood was dried up and she had been made whole again. So not only did she feel the relief from the drying up of the issue of blood, but virtue, life had come back within her body as well. And she felt genuinely that she had been healed. Now if we want the type of that while we're just thinking about it, the Lord Jesus Christ was obviously the divine altar. Hebrews 13 verse 10 tells us that. And she had made contact with the altar of God's providing. And Exodus 29 and verse 37 tells us that anybody who made contact with the divine altar is declared holy. And therefore she was cleansed of her uncleanness, because she had decided that the only way she could be cleansed was by touching the altar of God's provision. And that is literally what she did, and that's the type of it. Now, when we think from now verse 30 of Mark chapter 5, her joy, her great relief, and her general feeling of well-being, now for a moment, was to turn to consternation. Because what she wanted to avoid at all costs was now going to be a fact of life. Jesus immediately, in verse 30, knowing in himself that virtue, power, as the word means, had gone out of him, turned about in the press and said, "Who touched my clothes?" Now the last thing the woman wanted was to be found out. She didn't want any publicity. She didn't want anybody to know who she was. She wanted nobody. She wanted to just disappear again into the crowds. But it was not to be. She realized that the Master knew who she was and that she desired to be healed. Now bearing in mind, as many have said, and I think rightly, she wouldn't be the only person who had touched the Master. With that multitude, he couldn't have helped but being sort of buffeted and knocked and touched. And that's the point the disciples are saying in verse 31. The disciples said unto him, "Thou seest the multitude, and sayest thou, who touched me?" And he looked round about to see her that had done this thing. The Master knew who it was. He knew it was a woman. He knew which woman. And he knew the very reason she had done it. Now don't forget, we're dealing with someone who knew the thoughts and intents of everybody's heart. And that is a thought which we've got to carry with us during our pilgrimage. There's nothing hid from the Master. Everything is known and revealed to him. And therefore, this woman, obviously, in verse 33, fearing and trembling, knowing what was done in her, came and fell down before him and told him all the truth. Not that he needed to be told. He obviously knew already, but he wanted the confession on behalf of the woman. And it was as if it were that her sins had been forgiven. And the master says unto her, "Daughter, thy faith hath made thee whole. Go in peace and be whole of thy plague." If you'd like to just look at 1 John chapter 5. First Epistle of John and chapter 5. Notice the connection here in verse 2. "By this we know that we love the children of God, when we love God and keep his commandments." Remember, it was the fringe on the border of the garment which signified the commandments of God, that they may look upon them and do what the commandments said. So this is the fact that we love God when we keep his commandments. "For this is the love of God, that we keep his commandments, and his commandments are not grievous." In other words, it's not stopping us from doing things we didn't want to do. On the contrary, they're joyous. His commandments allow us to serve him in the way that he desires, and therefore they make us glad because we're doing things which give him pleasure. It was the Pharisees, remember, who thought the commandments were grievous. "Thou shalt not do this, thou shalt not do the other." They felt that the commandments of God was restrictive. The master says, "Thou shalt love the Lord thy God." He saw them as joyous, he saw them as positive. And therefore he goes on to say in verse 4, "Whatsoever is born of God overcometh the world, and this is the victory that overcometh the world, even our faith." So you've got the combination of the keeping of the commandments and the victory that is accomplished on the basis of our faith. So we are justified, we are made righteous on the basis of our faith, not by works, but by our faith in Christ Jesus. And this woman was made whole. Her victory, as it were, her justification, was on the basis of her faith, because she believed that the Master could cleanse her from all sin and iniquity. And we believe the same, because that's why a majority of us, at least, have been baptized into the saving name. And even those who haven't do understand and believe that it's through the blood of the Lord Jesus that we are cleansed from our sins. And therefore, this woman's faith caused her to be made whole again. But if you look back to verse 34 of Mark chapter 5, I'm going to suggest maybe there's another thought which we'd like to think about. Verse 34, "Daughter, thy faith hath made thee whole." Think about that. "And be whole of thy plague." As if the woman was, at the point of the issue of blood, not whole. Now, obviously, she was ill, and therefore she was not whole. But the idea was that she was incomplete. Now the master had made her complete again. Something had been missing in her life when she had the issue of blood. And now the master, having cured that, could cause this woman to be right again, completely right again, made whole. Now, I believe the thought is taken up in that phrase, "go in peace." Can I take you back to the first book of Samuel in chapter 1? Now, when Hannah goes unto the temple to pray that the Lord would grant her a request that she may give birth to a child, and we know the circumstances and we know the wonder of Hannah's prayer. When Eli, who was the priest at that time, came to her and thought originally she was drunk because she was mumbling to herself, and then he appreciated, you know, what was on her mind and what was being said from her heart. In verse 17 of 1 Samuel chapter 1, Eli answered and said, notice the phrase now, "Go in peace. And the God of Israel grant thee thy petition that thou hast asked of him." And what she was granted was that she was made whole, in other words, that she could bear children. And that was the request granted. And the response of Eli to Hannah was, "Go in peace. Thy faith hath made thee whole." To quote the words of the Master in Mark chapter 5. And I wonder, therefore, brethren and sisters, that in verse 34 of Mark chapter 5, that the Master is saying that this woman is complete again. In other words, the very reason and the desire of every woman would be to bear children. And that this woman, having an issue of blood for 12 years, was not able to do that. But it restored her to a whole woman again. And the very phrase used, "go in peace," seems to indicate that this may be the case. Now, the incident is well known. The lessons are fairly obvious. I'm going to suggest to you who this woman was. And although we can't prove it, we can't disprove it either. And therefore, I believe that the evidence in suggesting who she was will be greater than anything you can suggest that he couldn't be. So by the very law of average, I'm going to suggest who this woman was. We've got two miracles side by side. We've got the miracle of the woman with an issue of blood, and we've got the raising of Jairus' daughter. Now, the incident is such that we're told, if we go to Luke's account, can we just go to Luke chapter 9? In Luke chapter 9, and I'd like to begin reading there at verse 20, that the woman who'd got an issue of blood had had this problem for 12 years. 12 years. I've got the wrong thing. I'm sorry, I've got the wrong thing. It's Luke account. I want Luke chapter 8 and verse 43. I do apologize. Luke chapter 8, verse 43. The woman having an issue of blood, 12 years. And in verse 42, the previous verse, Jairus' daughter was about 12 years of age. So we've got the significance that both miracles were connected with 12 years. So, the second point that we've been given is that in verse 43, this woman had spent all her living upon physicians. And the idea of living is wealth. Where did the wealth of the woman come from? We're not told she was a widow. We're not told anything about her except she was a certain woman. And she'd had quite a bit of money that she'd gone from physician to physician to physician and spent all her wealth. How had she acquired that wealth? Thirdly, you will notice that when Jairus comes in verse 41, there's no mention of anything but his daughter. Whereas, when we come to the curing of the, or the raising from the dead of the daughter, in verse 51, we're going to look at this in detail in a second, when he came into the house, he suffered no man to go in save Peter and James and John, and the father and the mother of the maiden. Why should the master take the father and the mother? And why should it be specifically told us? Why didn't he do what Elijah did and raise the son of the Shunammite and then bring him out to the mother? Jesus specifically takes together the father and the mother. And I'm sure you've worked out what I'm suggesting, that the woman with the issue of blood was Jairus' wife. And after giving birth to the daughter, the afterbirth had not stemmed. And from that time onward, she'd had an issue of blood. And Jairus, being ruler of the synagogue, had no alternative but to put her out of the house and out of the camp. He had got no alternative whatsoever according to law. But naturally, he wanted to do everything that he could. So he gave her money to see what was possible to be bought was bought by the hands of the physicians in order that she might be cured. Now, it is possible, and I would suggest only possible, that Jairus also executed the law of Deuteronomy 24. If If you'd like to go to Deuteronomy chapter 24. And for some reason, a lot of Christadelphians get themselves all in a state about Deuteronomy 24, about the divorce laws. I never understand why, because it's as simple as ABC, but that's another matter. Let's just look at it in verse 1. That when a man hath taken a wife and married her, and it come to pass that she find no favour in his eyes because he hath found some uncleanness in her, then he was entitled under the law to write her a bill of divorcement and give it in her hand and send her out of the house. Now every man's desire in those days was to bear a son, for his wife to bear a son. A daughter, I'm sure, was loved as much, but was inferior in a Jewish household. Thankfully, it's not the same now. And therefore, every staunch Jew prayed to God every day that he had been born a woman. Such was the feeling of the Jewish people towards women. Now, Jairus, the ruler of the synagogue, would want a son to follow on the name. The daughter had been born, and then the wife was incapable of bearing any more children. And therefore, lawfully, he could put her away, and he could write her a bill of divorcement. But I would suggest to you that if he had done that, he still didn't remarry. Neither did she. And therefore, I believe that although he couldn't have her within the house or even within the congregation because it was unclean, the contact was still there. And the faith of the man, Jairus, and the faith of the woman was very similar towards the master. And I believe the ultimate fulfillment of all these things was that both husband and wife were reconciled at the time of the resurrection of the daughter. Now, as I say, I can't prove it, but neither can you disprove it. All I'm asking you to consider is the circumstantial evidence, as they would say, that we're told she was a certain woman, not just a woman, a certain woman, that the connection of the 12 years is highly significant. And thirdly, that the master makes the point that he was to take the father and the mother to the time when he was to raise her from the dead. And fourthly, up to that point in time, there'd been no mention of anything but Jairus' daughter. Now, if nothing else, it's very fitting and something for us to think about. But that then brings us back to Mark chapter 5 to think about the raising of this man's daughter. Verse 22. Behold, Mark chapter 5. There cometh one of the rulers of the synagogue, Jairus by name, and when he saw him, he fell at his feet. We're in Capernaum. The synagogue at Capernaum had witnessed some miracles of the master. Think of one, when they opened the roof and let down the man who was lame. Now, no doubt, Jairus, as a ruler of the synagogue, had been there to witness these wonderful events, and therefore he knew of the master. He knew the power of the master, and no doubt in his mind, perhaps like Nicodemus and others, he wanted to believe that the master was the Messiah. But perhaps prejudice, the concern of his job, what other fellow Jews might say, had caused him not to actually give up his position to become a disciple. But no doubt these things were in his mind very much so. No doubt on many occasions he witnessed the teaching and the miracles of the master, but without the full commitment. But now his daughter was dying. And of course it's in these sort of extreme circumstances which would cause even the most prejudiced of people to bury their pride and their prejudices and go for perhaps the only solution which was left to them. And I believe such was the attitude of Jairus. He couldn't care less now what other people said. He wasn't interested in his own position, what his fellow Jews might say, or anything. His only thought was to save his daughter's life. And I think we can all appreciate that. We can all appreciate with somebody so close and dear to us that we would forsake all in order that they might be saved. And therefore, when he comes to the Master, in full view, don't forget, of the multitude who would be worshippers at the synagogue, he fell down at the feet of the Master. He prostrated himself. And if you go to Matthew's account, in Matthew chapter 9, we find that there came a certain ruler in verse 18 who worshipped him. So he not only fell down at his feet, but he worshipped him. And the fact that the Master was willing to go with him would seem to indicate that the Master saw the faith of this man. He appreciated that what he was doing was genuine. He really believed that the Master could save his daughter's life. Right. If we can come back to Luke's account in Luke chapter 8. Verse 41, there came this Jairus, he fell down at Jesus' feet, besought him that he would come into his house. He had one daughter, about 12 years of age, lying, and as he went, the people thronged him. So try and picture the scene. He'd agreed to go with Jairus, and then we've got the crowds thronging him, and then we've got the incident, however long it took, of the woman who'd got the issue of blood. I wonder, brothers and sisters, whether he personally recognized who the woman was. For you to think about. Right. Verse 49 tells us, while he yet spake, there cometh one from the ruler of the synagogue's house, saying to Jairus, thy daughter is dead, trouble not the Master. So they, obviously, of his household, didn't think Jesus could raise the dead. But if you took notice of Matthew's account, Matthew chapter 9 and verse 18, when you were there, while he spake these things, behold, there came a certain ruler and worshipped him, saying, my daughter is even now dead, but come and lay thy hand upon her, and she shall live. So although the people who'd come to give him the message doubted, Jairus didn't. Although he had originally come to the Master while his daughter was still alive, he then had the representation from his household that she died, but that didn't deter Jairus. He still believed that Jesus could even now raise him from the dead. And of course, that's what was going to happen. So, we find that in verse 50 of Luke chapter 8, when Jesus heard it, he answered him, saying, fear not, believe only, and she shall be made whole. The Revised Version says, she shall be saved. Can we go back to Mark chapter 5 now to take up the narrative? Because it's interesting as we know. Verse 37. He suffered no man to follow him, save Peter and James and John, the brother of James. And he cometh to the house of the ruler of the synagogue, and seeth the tumult, and them that wept and wailed greatly. And apart from the close relatives, who obviously would be very upset and sorrowful that the young child had died, in those days, as you possibly know, they also had professional mourners. Those who were sort of hired to make the right sort of noises and to give the impression that they were very sort of upset about what had happened. And of course, the Jews, like a lot of the Eastern countries, make a big play of funerals. They love funerals as much as they like weddings. And they put on a great show. And of course, the Jews particularly, you know, the more people you invited, the more people all weeping and wailing gave the impression of how important you were. And as the ruler of the synagogue, no doubt, he obviously had everything done properly. And in verse 39, when he was come in, he said unto them, "Why make ye this ado and weep? The damsel is not dead, but sleepeth." And obviously, we understand totally what the master was saying. You don't have those professional mourners and all that if somebody's just gone to bed to sleep. And that was what he was implying. So in verse 40, they laughed him to scorn. One or two interesting quotations here. I'd like to go to Acts chapter 26. Remember when Paul was in front of Agrippa? He says to him in verse 8, "Why should it be thought a thing incredible with you that God should raise the dead?" So obviously they were incredulous about the fact of the resurrection. They just laughed it to scorn. They couldn't believe that anyone could be raised from the dead. And if you go back to Acts chapter 17, when Paul was at Athens, you get the same sort of thing there. Verse 32, "When they heard of the resurrection of the dead, some mocked, but others said, 'We will hear thee again of the matter.'" And it may be our own experience when we've talked to people about the kingdom to come and the return of Jesus, and we've talked about the resurrection from the dead. You know, some people do laugh. They think it's impossible. You know, that's stupid. How can you believe such thing? But the thing what we've got to remember in the context of Mark chapter 5 is that he was the ruler of the synagogue and more than likely a Pharisee. And if there was one distinction between the Pharisees and the Sadducees, is that the Pharisees believed in the resurrection from the dead. The Sadducees didn't, as we've often said. That's why they were Sadducees. But the Pharisees believed in the resurrection from the dead. And therefore Jairus was no doubt a believer. But those who had gone there to weep and wail obviously didn't. So the master puts them out. And therefore he takes hold in verse 40, Mark chapter 5, of the father and the mother. And I'm suggesting that was the first reunion of mother and father for 12 long years. And he takes with him Peter, James and John, and entereth in where the damsel was lying. And he took the damsel by the hand and said unto her, "Talitha cumi," which is being interpreted, "Damsel, I say unto thee, arise." Talitha cumi is Aramaic, not Hebrew. Now, it has been suggested, and I'm a believer of this, that in everyday language, Jesus spoke Aramaic. It was the language of the area, particularly around Galilee. Very few Jews spoke Hebrew, apart from in the synagogue. And the common language was Aramaic. And I believe that in everyday speech, the master spoke Aramaic. It was only when he was in the temple and when he was disputing with the elders that he would speak Hebrew. This is definitely Aramaic, as Strong and all the authorities tell us. The interesting thing here, he would be in the house of the ruler of the synagogue. And therefore the ruler of the synagogue had admitted the law could not save his daughter. There was nothing in the law which could cause her to be made whole again. And therefore he had to rely upon the master, who instead of speaking in the religious tongue, which was Hebrew of that time, spoke in the everyday language. To demonstrate, I believe, that he obviously was not sent simply to the rulers and the hierarchy and the religious, but he was sent to all men and women. And therefore, if everyday man and woman, he would speak to them. We find in verse 42 that But straightway the damsel arose and walked, for she was the age of 12 years, and they were astonished with great astonishment. And he charged them straightly that no man should know it, and commanded that something should be given her to eat. Now again, it's not uncommon, as we have seen on many occasions, that the master did not want publicity. He did not want anyone to be told about these things at that moment in time. But there's one thing which I'd like you to think about. Can we just look at, keep your finger in Mark and just come over to Luke. Verse 55. And her spirit came again, and she arose straightway, and he commanded to give her meat. Mark tells us he commanded that something should be given her to eat. Luke makes the point that she should be given meat. Now, I hope I'm going to have the answer from you later on about this. But there's a great play on this woman, this child, receiving something to eat after she'd been raised from the dead. Now, presumably, she'd been ill for at least a few days. No doubt was weak before she died. And therefore, it was not unnatural that being raised from the dead, she should be given something to eat. But it was not beyond the Lord's power, obviously, to raise her in a state where she wouldn't need food apart from normal circumstances. But immediately, he told her that she'd got to eat. Now that gave me something to think about, and I'd like to go through a few passages with you, brethren and sisters. Can we go to Luke chapter 24? Because the one thing which I found quite remarkable is that every time a resurrection takes place, we find the people eating. We've got it here in Luke 24 with the master. Look at verse 41. While they yet believed not for joy and wondered, he said unto them, Have you here any meat? And they gave him a piece of broiled fish and of an honeycomb, and he took it and did eat before them. Now the master was immortal by this time. Now if it was natural for Jairus' daughter to need food for sustenance, it certainly wasn't for the master. He was now energized by spirit. He had no need of natural food. And yet, specifically, he says to them, have you got any meat? And he ate it before them. Now, if you go to Acts chapter 1, remember the opening of the chapter, and in verse 4, and being assembled together with them, commanded them that they should not depart from Jerusalem, but wait for the promise of the Father. And if you've got a central margin to the phrase being assembled together, and eating together with them, commanded them that they should not depart from Jerusalem. So they were eating together again. So the emphasis after the Lord's resurrection, that he was eating with them. Now again, if you go to Acts chapter 10, remember Peter with Cornelius speaking about Jesus from verse 36 onwards. He comes down to verse 39. We are witnesses of all these things of which he, Jesus, did both in the land of the Jews and in Jerusalem, whom they slew and hanged on a tree. Him God raised up the third day and showed him openly, not to all the people, but unto witnesses chosen of God, even to us, who did eat and drink with him after he rose from the dead. So again, the emphasis which Peter places upon it, that they ate and drank with him. Now, if you go forward to Revelation chapter 3, Revelation chapter 3, And we're coming down to verse 20, to the promise to those of Laodicea who overcome. He says in verse 20, "Behold, I stand at the door and knock. If any man hear my voice and open the door, I will come unto him and will sup with him and he with me." So one of the blessings upon the redeemed, the bride of Christ, the ones who are going to be accepted after the resurrection, is that they will sup with him. And that's endorsed in Revelation chapter 19 and verse 9, when we are called to the marriage supper of the Lamb. So again, the emphasis is upon we shall eat and drink with the Master. Now we're told we shall eat and drink anew with him as far as the memorial feast is concerned, but this is something above and beyond that. Now, if at that time, God willing, we're immortal, we will not have any need to eat and drink, and yet we will. It will be one of the benefits and the pleasures of being with the Master to enjoy a meal with him, as the apostles did, obviously on numerous occasions, after his resurrection. Now also, something else you might like to think about, come back to John's Gospel in chapter 12. You remember in John chapter 11, he'd raised Lazarus from the dead. And the very next thing we find about Lazarus is in chapter 12 and verse 1. "Then Jesus, 6 days before the Passover, came to Bethany, where Lazarus was, which had been dead, whom he raised from the dead. There they made him a supper, and Martha served, but Lazarus was one of them that sat at the table with him." Again, after the resurrection of Lazarus, he's eating and drinking. So the strongest proof of resurrection was that people ate. Now, I can understand it, like I've said, from a natural point of view, that if they're weak, then they would need sustenance. From the Master's point of view, the only point I can come to is that if he was just a spirit, then he wouldn't be able to eat in the normal way. And therefore he wanted to demonstrate that he'd got a body which had got the same functions as a natural body. And yet to me there's so much evidence, so much proof put to the fact that almost to prove resurrection, then somebody ate. I'm thinking there must be a stronger reason. And almost as if it were the Master was saying, this is the acid test, this is the real proof of resurrection, that we shall eat. Now the only thing I can think of is to show that we have got the same body, inverted commas, from a functional point of view. But I just think there must be something, there's so much evidence of the scriptures upon it, but no doubt we can think about that a bit later on. But this was the fact, coming back to Mark chapter 5, that the whole family was now reunited. And what a joyous family it would have been. With, if we're correct, the woman cured of the issue saw not only her being reunited with her husband, but also the family was complete, and if we are correct, she would be able to continue to have more family and there produce the offspring of the Lord. And as we have said all the way through, we've got 5 minutes? Yeah. There's many lessons, most of which are fairly obvious to us. Can I suggest that there is an overall type, overall principles in these two miracles? That the one of them is particular to the Jews, and that's the raising of Jairus' daughter. And the second one is one to the Gentiles, because we've got this woman who was unclean. Her failure to get any relief from doctors was like Gentiles unable to get any relief from other religions apart from the true one. Now if you go to Ephesians chapter 2, brethren and sisters, you remember the way that Paul describes the Gentiles. He says, remember in verse 11, that ye being in time past Gentiles in the flesh, who are called uncircumcision, that which is called the circumcision of the flesh made with hands, that at that time you were without Christ, being aliens from the commonwealth of Israel, strangers from the comers of promise, having no hope and without God in the world. And basically, in one sense, that was like this woman. She was alien from the commonwealth of Israel. She was without the camp. She had no means of worshipping according to the way that God had laid down. And therefore, as far as she was concerned, she'd got no hope whatsoever. And therefore, she represents, I believe, the Gentiles in that unclean state, unable to find a means of curing themselves. But then, on the basis of faith, on the basis of Christ's commandments, she could be cured. An interesting fact again to consider. She came to the Master from behind. That's what the record told us, and that's what we stressed. Now, we said to you, from a natural point of view, she didn't want to be recognized. She didn't want to be seen. She didn't want to be identified, and therefore she surreptitiously came from behind. But as far as the Gentiles were concerned, they did come from behind as far as the salvation of God was concerned. Because the salvation first and foremost had to be to the Jew. And therefore Jesus said, I was not sent but to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. And the Gentiles could not be incorporated into the salvation of God until after the resurrection of the Master and the preaching of the truth by the apostles. Therefore they came from behind as far as the truth was concerned. Whereas, when we come to Zechariah chapter 8, we've got a lovely thought there in this connection of what this woman did. Zechariah chapter 8 and verse 23, you could recite the words, you know them well, but think of it in this context. In those days it shall come to pass that 10 men shall take hold out of all languages of the nations, even shall take hold of the skirt of him that is a Jew, saying, we will go with you, for we've heard that God is with you. And I believe that the idea there is to take the hem of the garment. They take the border of the garment, because that is the commandments of God, and they have heard that God is with them. And the only future for the nations of the world at the time of the kingdom will be to associate themselves with the things of God, which are Jewish in principle. And therefore they will take hold of the skirt of him that is a Jew, because only through that means the hope of Israel is salvation assured. And that's what this woman did. But what about the Jairus' daughter? Well, we've got a sick child. The sick child of someone who was a ruler of the synagogue. And I believe this child was demonstrative of Israel's spiritual condition at the time of the Master. They were sick. They were weak. And the synagogue was hopeless and helpless. There was nothing that the Jewish religion, the tradition of the elders, could do about it. But you will notice that the Master doesn't immediately go and cure the sick child. There was going to be this other miracle performed first, and that was going to be upon the Gentiles. And it was only after the Gentiles had been cured, as represented by the woman with an issue of blood, that the Jewish child could be made whole. And it wasn't until the fullness of the Gentiles is come in that the Lord Jesus Christ will restore Israel again to spiritual health. Think about the fact that the Jews rejected the Master. They remained in that weak and sickly state, and to all intents and purposes died. Because Ezekiel 37 sees the nation of Israel as a valley full of dead men's bones. And the intervening time since the coming of the Master and the destruction in AD 70 has been the time of the Gentiles. And if we go to Romans and chapter 11, words we know well. Verse 25, I would not, brethren, that you should be ignorant of this mystery, lest ye should be wise in your own conceit, that blindness in part is happened to Israel until the fullness of the Gentiles be come in, and so Israel shall be saved. And so the Master does not restore Israel to health and strength until the Gentiles have been saved, as demonstrated by the curing of the woman with the issue. But when he does come, disaster has overtaken the nation. All hope has been lost. But he will respond to their plea. He will raise from the death, as it were, God's own stricken nation. And he will insist then that food be given to them. And we'll very quickly go to Jeremiah chapter 31. And this is the food that he gives to them when he returns to raise them, as it were, from the dead, Ezekiel 37, and to give them life again. Verse 31, "Behold, the days come, saith the Lord, that I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah." And what's this? Verse 33, "This shall be the covenant that I will make with the house of Israel. I will put my law in their inward parts and write it upon their hearts, and will be their God, and they shall be my people." That which was represented by the hem of his garments, Israel had ignored. "That you may look upon the hem and do the commandments of God." And Israel refused. The Gentiles have accepted. In those days, when he will restore them to health and strength, he will give them the meat of the law again. And therefore, Malachi chapter 4 says he will restore the law of Moses to them. But this time, he will write it upon their hearts, not the phylacteries of their foreheads, but upon their hearts, and by that means they will be sustained. Have I done? Okay.